Hey everyone, thanks for tuning in to a new episode of Talk Back with C.E. Moore. This time around, fiction editor Melissa Willis takes the reins as she sits down to talk with K. Marshall Strom about her newest book, The Hope of Shardula.
I'm with K. Marshall Strom today, and we are discussing the second book in your Blessings of India series called The Hope of Shardula. Tell us a little bit about this series, and then specifically The Hope of Shardula.
Well, this is a historical fiction. I call it global historical fiction. And it pretty much spans the whole 19th century, telling the story of two families, a high caste landowner family and the untouchable family, as they were known at the beginning of the century, the untouchable family who is owned by the high caste family. They're virtual slaves. And what happens to this family, how the two families interact, and I won't tell you how the series ends.
Well, I guess we'll just have to wait until the third book, won't we?
Yes.
Now, what was the inspiration for this series, and how do you go about researching it?
Well, I have been to India about 8 different times, mostly working on other books. But it's interesting because after I had been there a number of times and got to know several different people, one man especially said to me, "Why don't you ever write a book that shows the plight of Dalits, which is now what untouchables are called?" And he said, "Why don't you write about us? People in the world don't know our plight. They don't know our history. They don't know anything about us." And so it was Sam Paul who asked me to write this that really got me started thinking about it.
Okay. So have you been over there doing missionary work or as part of your research?
Part of my research for other books, mostly nonfiction books, I do quite a bit of writing in the area of Christian social justice. And so researching for these types of issues, I've been over there.
Okay. Now, the Dalit or untouchable family in this story, we get to follow Ashish. We got to meet him in the first book called The Fate of Ashish. And he was a boy then. And in The Hope of Shardula, he's now grown into a man. And I've loved watching his story progress, and he's had so many pivotal points in his life. What do you think has been most influential in molding him into the character that we find at the beginning of this book?
Well, I don't think there's any doubt but what the most important thing is the English Bible that was given to him by a missionary who didn't quite follow what missionaries were expected to do at that time, and gave him that Bible, taught him to read, taught him the beginning of reading in English, and he worked and worked and worked until he could read the Bible. That is the defining point, actually, throughout the series.
Now, you mentioned the missionary, Abigail Davidson, is the that you're referring to, and you said that she wasn't exactly conventional. Talk about what made her different, what separated her from the traditional missionary at that time.
Yes, and I don't want to be overly general, because certainly all missionaries didn't fit into any certain package. But generally speaking, the missionaries were more like the English colonials were. They saw themselves on a higher plane. They felt like they were doing good deeds to reach down and help these untouchables, and they were called untouchables at that time. That didn't change until independence. So they looked upon it as alms to the poor, and they lived in many cases in a totally English way. They dressed in English clothes. They only spoke English. They rejected the mores of the people and insisted on holding on to their Englishism. And that was offensive to a lot of the people. But Abigail Davidson threw herself into where she was. She dressed Indian, she ate Indian, and she learned to speak their language. And that made all the difference.
Is there a historical or a missionary that you came across during your research that she's kind of based on? Or
yes. Actually, that's a good question, because all of the characters in these books, I know that we say any similarity to anybody living and dead is purely coincidental. But really, they are all inspired by people I met or people who told me the stories of their families. And so although it is fiction and the storyline is fiction, it is very much based on the way people were and what happened to them. Probably the best compliment I've gotten on this series is from an Indian man who said to me, "It's like you live here among us." And I thought, yes, that's what I wanted.
Well, I mean, I've never been to India, but just listening, I mean, just reading it, it matches up with things that I've heard about in the past. Mm-hmm. And it has a very authentic feel to it. I mean, I'm in no position to be able to judge its authenticity, but just reading it, it's got an emotional drive behind it, not an authentic feel that just really, I mean, I've said whenever I reviewed The Faith of Ashish, that really wasn't a normal book I would pick up. It was kind of outside my genre, but I just liked the look of the storyline. It sounded great, and so I picked it up and just loved it. I couldn't believe it, and a lot of it was because it felt so real. I felt like I was sitting there with Ashish's family as they endured the humiliation and just a simple mistake kicks off the whole string that affects generations.
Right.
And
that's right.
I couldn't believe it, but it felt real. I could believe it. I guess that's the thing. I could believe it, even though it should never happen. That never should have happened. But it was so authentic that I totally believed that could have happened at any point in time.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. And that was large part of my goal, because, you know, most of us in this country, we don't know India at all. Here it is, the second most populous country in the world, and our knowledge of it is very superficial.
I agree with you completely there. And one of the things that I didn't realize, this book takes place in the 1940s, the series is in the early 1900s, and then this one was in the 1940s. And this one takes place during a time of great turmoil for India.
Yes.
Talk about the social and the political elements of the time period in which you're writing about.
Well, this is the time period of the fight for independence and then the partition of India into India and Pakistan. And it was a time of turmoil in so many ways. Throwing off the colonial rule was a big part of it. But India was not a unified group of people. It was a lot of little tribes, so to speak. And they all had their own rulers. They all had their own ways of doing things, their own language. And so to unify this group was amazing. And the fight on the part of the Muslim leaders to have a country of their own was wrenching, absolutely wrenching. And as Pakistan was formed as the Indians said, you cut off the top of our head and made a new country out of it. And so it caused a lot of problems, perhaps more problems than it solved. And it was interesting because when I was working on this, I had to do a lot of research for it. But as I was doing the research, I talked about it on my Facebook page, and I have a number of Indian people who follow me. But an old Indian man wrote to me and he said, I was there. I was 15 years old in that conflict. And he gave me a lot of details to put into that section.
Wow. See, that, because one of the things that you mentioned early on here was that most, you know, people here in the U.S. really don't know what's going on in India. I had no clue. I could not have told you beyond hearing the name Gandhi anything about that time period. And I had no idea that the communists had any sort of influence in that. I didn't understand the differences with the Muslims, how impactful that that religion was. And so whenever I was reading this, you talk about, you know, three main political groups there, and the youngest son of the landowner, Nahil Amos, he is a communist.
Mm-hmm.
And what was interesting about that is that of the three groups, the communists seemed to be the ones that were most focused on helping the plight of the Dalit. And so I'm just curious, where did they actually fit into that? Because I never knew that communism was at all influential in India. That was
communism. Communism was and still is very influential in the country. It's interesting because at this time of this book, around the time of independence, one of the men that I know in India, and I was talking to a couple of them, said, oh, we were both very active in the Communist Party. We looked and we saw who was helping the poor. They are both higher caste. And they said, certainly the higher castes aren't helping them. Certainly the Hindus aren't helping them. The Christians aren't really even doing anything substantial to help them. They said, who's helping them? So that's why they went to communism. And they said, you know, really, we all said, if you are not a communist by the time you're 18, you don't have a heart. And they said, but if you are still a communist after you're 21, you don't have a brain. That was what they said. Because as they got into the Communist Party, they saw it wasn't helping them either. So it was a real pull and a real difficult thing. There was a good possibility that India would become communist at one time. But and in some states, it's much more influential today than it is in other states.
Okay. That was all news to me, and I thought that it was so interesting the way that each of these three factions seemed to try. It seemed like that they knew what the problem was. They knew that the problem was they had a group of people that was oppressed, but nobody really seemed to want to fix it. And one of the, I mean, there's a lot of memorable lines in this book, and I go through, I read on a Kindle, and I highlight them as I go through. This really sticks out. And one of them, there's this exchange between Gloriana, the landowner's daughter, and Shradula, who is Ashish's daughter, and it kind of sums up the whole overall issue in India. Gloriana says, you know, I would not mind if you lived like me, but I would never want to live like you. And, you know, that kind of sums up, seemed to be the heart of the problem with resolving this issue with the Dalits. And so briefly explain the situation in India that has created a society where the rich remain rich and the rich and the poor are poor, and those like Gloriana who can see this travesty are so few and far between.
Yes, the whole social order is so different than it is in our country that it's difficult to understand. People say to me all the time, well, the situation in the days of slavery in our country was just the same. It wasn't the same. It was horrible, and I've written about that in another series, but it wasn't the same. And here's the big difference. In Indian philosophy, Hinduism is a philosophy, not truly a religion, but a philosophy. And in their philosophy, they believe that the high caste are high caste because they have earned this position in former lives, and they should not really help the poor too much because they are there as punishment for their former lives. So it would be almost like us going into a prison, into the maybe the cells where they were holding lifers, and saying, "Well, you know, let me get you out and give you a new outfit of clothes, and let me give you some education." We would say, "Well, wait a minute, they have to pay for their crimes against society," and that's how the high caste feel to the untouchables. There's the four levels of the caste system, but the untouchables are not in the caste system. They're below the caste system. They are untouchable. Some so untouchable that they were considered unseeables. You weren't allowed to look at them because it was defiling even to put your eyes on them. And the thing is, the people in that underclass, outcast, basically, felt that they belonged there. They did not fight against where they were because they had been taught, if you fight, if you argue, if you resist, that's just going to get you back here in the next life again. You better be a good untouchable and earn the right to move up in society in your rebirth.
That's just a nice little way to keep things exactly as they are. And
that's right.
But, I mean, what do you think ultimately is going to need to be done for it to change? I mean, I can see it and look at it and say, you know, that's just a scam. There's people are going to be hopeless in so many ways. If you're born into the untouchable caste, then what hope is there to move up? And you have to obey for any hope to move up into the next life. So what do you think really needs to be done?
Well, it sounds a little pat, but the best thing that has happened to India, and many Indians, even Hindus, will say this, is the introduction of Christianity. The fact, the idea that all men, all women, all girls are created equal in the sight of God is an absolutely revolutionary idea. Revolutionary idea. And that we have a responsibility for one another. That's a revolutionary idea. But those are Christian ideas that have been injected into society. And one Hindu told me while I was there, he said, the best things among us are the things that have come about through Christianity.
Wow, that says a lot right there, for especially all the people that have went over there to spread Christianity. And, you know, one of the other memorable lines that I loved in this book, and this is probably my favorite, is Zia, who is Ashish's wife, while he's reading the Bible, she says, that book is dangerous. She really doesn't quite know how right she really is in that it is dangerous. And, yeah, that's one. There were several spiritual themes that you brought out in this series and presented several passages of scripture as Ashish is reading them and trying to figure them out in some cases. What do you want the readers to take away from this series?
I think the biggest criticism I have gotten is that in the faith of Ashish, and maybe that will also be a criticism with Shradula, is that there's not a conversion story. But you know, he goes through this, and where's the conversion? What I want them to see is that the road that these Indians who have a whole different mindset and background, the road that they're traveling toward faith is not an easy road, and it doesn't happen overnight. And so I want people to see and appreciate the path that this country is on and the influence and the impact that Christians are making in it. It's something we should all, I believe, be praying about for our Christian brothers and sisters in India, because it's not an easy road for them.
I think that's very, very valid. Something that I hope you're right. I mean, how could people, if they wanted to help, is there any missionary organizations or something like that that you've worked with in helping to spread Christianity?
Yes, there's a number of different missionary organizations that are doing wonderful work there. I particularly support one that is called Partners International, and they work with indigenous Indians who are working among their own people. So it's not bringing Americans in, which you can't legally do anyway now as missionaries, but it's not trying to lay Western Christianity on a different people. It is allowing the people who live there, who are true believers and followers of Christ and the Scripture, to lead the way with their own people. And I think that's a wonderful thing.
That is good. I think it's also in Indonesia, maybe, or China, I think, as well. We have some missionaries that were from our church that were from South Korea, and because they could speak, it wasn't as big of a jump to go from English to Chinese or to some of the Indonesian languages, that they moved from the U.S. to China to start trying to spread the gospel there, because it was more of a culture identity, I guess you could say. They could identify a little bit closer with the culture versus Americans coming in and trying to put their brand of Christianity on there. It sounds like what you're talking about here. What was the name of the organization again? Partnership International?
Partners International.
Partners International.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and it's in based in Spokane, Washington. There's also a branch in Canada, as a matter of fact, and in a couple of other places. But I was going to say, too, it's interesting to note, people may not be aware, that English is the business language and the language of education in India. Anybody who has any education speaks English to some degree. That's one of the ways that the Dalits are held down. They are not allowed education that teaches them English, so they are stymied. They can't go into secondary school and into university because they don't speak the language.
Wow! In the glossary at the back of this book, and I believe it's also at the back of the Faith of Ashish, you break down how many people, or the percentage of the population that's in the untouchable class or the Dalits. What is that percentage?
I would have to look up and see exactly what it was.
Off the top of my head, I remember it was a significant portion of the population.
Well, it is. It's like a third of the population, basically, is Dalit. And then the other two-thirds is divided between the four castes. Of the other two-thirds, half of those are in the lowest of the four castes, which are the servant caste. So really, only half of the two-thirds are people, those high castes, that rule everything.
Wow. And other people have to fight to survive. At least
that's right.
What we get
that's
from,
exactly right.
You know, from what I'm gathering, is that it's a struggle to survive. What's going to be next on your writing schedule?
There is one more book in this series, and that is The Love of Divina, and it will be out in September, 1st of September, and that will finish the series. That one is set in the 1990s, so that brings us up more to today. But after that, I'm going to be working on other fiction that is based on the global themes. I've done a lot of traveling in because of my other writing to a number of other countries, and I want I want to share our global family in a way that is palatable and interesting, rather than, you know, lecture, okay, here's your geography lesson for today, you know, not that.
Right.
So I'm going to be working, and I have a couple of possibilities and interesting proposals that are being looked at, but nothing to share just yet. But there is the one more book of this series coming out.
Looking forward to that one. But especially since it's in the 1990s, it tells me some things already. So
yes.
I'm looking forward to see who we get to, where we're at in this family's journey, in both families' journey.
Now, all of the names of the main characters, Ashish in book one, Shridula in book two, and Davina in book three, are names for blessing. They mean blessing. So that's where the blessings in India comes from.
Oh, I see. I did not make that connection. I knew Ashish did, but and I guess I did know Shridula did as well, because that's mentioned. But I guess since I haven't read the third, I wouldn't know yet.
Well, yeah, and that's the thread that ties them together. But when people say to me, "But what about this? What about?" I say, "Hold on until book three."
Well, where can people find out more about you and your books?
Well, they are certainly welcome to visit me on my website, www.kaystrom, spelled out kaystrom.com. And I would love to have anybody come by and visit there. They can also find out from the publisher. That is at www.abingdonpress.com. So either of those places, they can find out more about the book and contact me if they'd like. And, of course, I'm on Facebook also.
Okay. Is it just is it a K-Strom or is it K-Novels?
K-Strom.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for joining me today. I appreciate it. And I love talking about the series with you. It's very interesting. Just a fascinating series to, you know, a great way to learn history. even if there wasn't a story that was interesting, it's still a great way to learn history.
Well, thank you so much. And it's been so nice talking to you, as you can probably tell. I love talking about it too.
Well, thank you so much. And we look forward to seeing the last book in the series, The Love of Davina, coming up in September.
Right. Yeah. That's coming out sooner than I can imagine. So, yeah, thank you so much.
And thank you. And I'll have Calvin in the recording right about there. But I did want to say I am sorry for throwing numbers at you. I follow the course of the conversation. If I had known that our conversation would go that direction, I would have told you in advance, can you pull up the numbers?
Well, I should have them right at the top of my head, but you know, I've worked on a couple of things since I worked on this, and I've forgotten.
Oh, it's no problem. I didn't realize that until I got going, and I was like, you know, I want to at least put a mental picture so people kind of know how large of a population we're talking about here. And I get the numbers pulled up either. So I didn't want to put you on the spot. I apologize for that.
That's no problem.
I just wanted to try to get that out there. But again, thank you so much. I really do appreciate it. And maybe we can do this again when the next book comes out.
Well, I would love that. I would really, really enjoy that. I appreciate your review, and I appreciate your interest and your encouragement. That means a lot to me.
That's no problem. And I will make sure to send you the link to the review and the interview when they post.
Oh, super. That's great. Okay.
Well, you have a great evening.
And you too.
I'll be in touch with you soon.